You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. We're doing a special edition of the podcast today, looking at the methodology behind our new Europe teaching rankings. Joining me today is our editorial director for global rankings, Phil Beatty, and our director for data and analytics, Duncan Ross. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in today. It's pretty difficult to get the two of you in one room, so I would like to pat myself on the back for accomplishing this feat. We've got some new rankings coming out, but these are quite different from what we usually call new rankings. These are European teaching rankings that have managed to measure teaching excellence across various countries in Europe. Phil, do you want to start off just telling us exactly what we're doing here?
Yeah, I'm really excited, actually, because this is a really pioneering piece of work that we've done. Obviously, we've been publishing the world rankings since 2004. The world university rankings have always had a heavy emphasis on research excellence. We have 30% of the weightings of the world rankings at looking at citations. Another 30% look at research funding, research reputation, research productivity. And although we've worked hard for the world rankings to make those balanced and to include metrics around the teaching environment and knowledge transfer, we have always been very conscious that the global rankings are heavily dominated by research metrics. And our investment in data and data science and Duncan's team have really given us the resource and the opportunity to have a really serious look at teaching excellence. And I think for me, as an editor of the rankings for almost a decade, it is something that is really, really much needed and incredibly challenging, but also pioneering. So I think it's a great opportunity, but it's also an opportunity to work with the community to get it right. And I think that's the important point, that this is really a sort of a pilot ranking, a consultative approach. And I'm sure Duncan will explain, we've faced many challenges along the way, and we're very happy to get this far, but we have further to go.
So when you say consultative approach, you're really wanting the universities to get involved in the data collection of this and in shaping the future rankings that we come out.
Well, universities and also governments and potentially prospective students as well. You know, feedback on what students find useful is always interesting. But the role of governments can't be underestimated. We're very lucky in the UK that we're in a data-rich environment. We have HESA, who put together some fantastic data about universities. But by and large, as you go across the world, you find that those data sources drop away. The availability of high-quality data that focuses on teaching from institutions is very, very limited. And we think this is a major challenge, particularly given the growth of international students. If you're a prospective student in China, how do you tell whether LMU is producing the quality education you want rather than, say, Amsterdam or PSL or whoever it might be? How do you get that comparative insight? It's a real challenge.
Yeah, and I think there's a classic criticism of the traditional world rankings is, why are they so focused on research? And actually, the THE world rankings are a geopolitical indicator. They really demonstrate a university's strength in the knowledge economy. It's right that research plays a role. But I think we have to be really honest as well and say one of the reasons research dominates all of the global rankings is that it's much easier to gather research information, and there's global consensus as to what metrics are appropriate and they apply across the world. When it comes to teaching, the kind of things that you want to get hold of to rank universities based on teaching is incredibly patchy. So, for example, you know, and I think what's exciting about this European ranking is it does build on a framework that Duncan created when he built the rankings for the Wall Street Journal. We do the US college rankings. So we set out some principles there using a very rich data set within the US context. So lots of rich information about student outcomes. Are they paying their debts back? Are they graduating on time? What are their graduate salaries? All these sorts of data sources. But we're building a consensus around the type of metrics, but then mapping them across a diverse range of different countries and systems. That has been a huge challenge, and that has led to compromises. I think that's why we want to have the conversation around the launch of the rankings to say, look, we've done some great things here. We've really taken some great steps forward, but we need to keep pushing and keep working with the universities to ensure we are able to collect the right data and make it comparable across the world.
And we will be launching these rankings on July 11th at our Teaching Excellence Summit that's going to be hosted by the University of Glasgow from July 10th to the 11th. Can we just go into a little bit about what we can expect to see? Are all of the countries in Europe ranked in this?
No, we had to make some tough decisions about how far we could extend the ranking, partly just in terms of capacity. You know, I think it can't be understated the amount of work that was required to try and ensure that we collected the right data in different geographies. So our focus has been initially on Western Europe, and we're taking in most of the major countries in Western Europe: Germany, France, Spain, Portugal, Italy, the UK, Ireland, the Netherlands. And really out of that, we're accounting for the vast majority of the Western Europe's higher education system. So it's not all countries. We would love to expand it in future. But one of the interesting limitations has been around our pioneering use of a survey of current students. Now, the limitation there is again about how do we push that out into new territories, how do we make sure that the results are comparable, and that the questions we're asking make sense to different countries. So that's been another limitation, again, one that I would happily expand in the future, particularly as we get more institutions to come on board and to deliver that survey to their students directly. That makes life a lot more straightforward and gets higher response rates.
Yeah, one of the compromises that I was found quite challenging was that in order to ensure we get sufficiently robust samples of students from the student survey, because it's a very laborious process to go across the world, and in this case across Western Europe, and get sufficiently large numbers of respondents to the survey, we've actually restricted the admissions process for the ranking to those slightly larger institutions with at least 5,000 undergraduate students, which is a shame in a sense because there are clearly smaller institutions who will have lots to say and lots to celebrate around teaching. So we've had to make some compromises in terms of the data quality. And one of the reasons I think we're pushing this idea that it's consultative is if you feel strongly that you want to be part of this ranking and you believe passionately that this is a great opportunity for you to demonstrate your strengths, where perhaps in other rankings, research-led rankings or prestige-led rankings, you are less well recognised, this is an opportunity to come forward and actually actively get involved and come to us and work with us to ensure we're able to collect enough data on you for the future.
Yeah, and just to emphasise what Phil said there, you know, the focus there was, and the reason for the 5,000 number was just simply to ensure that when we surveyed students, we actually got good response rates, and so the data we have available is consistent and reliable. And there are some countries this has had more effect than others. So in France, and we were in Paris yesterday, the many smaller institutions in France, some of them very well known, simply don't pass that threshold at the moment.
The threshold of
5,000 undergraduate students. So we're very keen to expand that in future years. But we still think, despite that, actually, there's some interesting insights that will come out of this approach.
Do we know what's the official figure of the response rate or the responses of students who took the pan-European survey?
So the answer is that it varies hugely from country to country. And since we use a panel approach, the traditional measure of response rate isn't quite the metric you're after. Mm. But as I say, then the focus there, the advantage we have here is, of course, we're not dividing this up by subject. So we're not looking at hyper-focused sub-segments of our sample. We're looking at the entire university, which allows us to work on a slightly smaller scale sample than we would otherwise.
Okay, so we've got the student survey. What else are these rankings based on? What else are you looking at?
Well, the four areas that Phil alluded to earlier are consistent with what we've done in the US and what we've done in Japan. And so those break down into resources. Conceptually, think of the things you need to have in place in order to deliver successful student experience. Then we have a section on student engagement, and really that's trying to get at the insight from what it's like to actually be a student. You know, what do you get taught? What styles of teaching are in place in your institution? We have a section on outcomes. So that's an attempt to look at, does the university provide the outcome? Do you graduate, for example? Or can you expect to graduate? And then finally, we have a section that we call environment. And in the case of Europe, we have focused very strongly on gender issues there. Have universities been doing their part in terms of providing equality of access?
And I think that's something I'd really champion from the rooftops, actually. I've had a lot of lobbying over the years about how rankings can incentivize good behavior. There's lots of perverse incentives around rankings and concerns about how they're used or gamed by universities. And a lot of pressure has been put on us to say, look, can you do anything to help sort out the gender inequality challenges in higher education? And the answer is we've struggled until now on the basis of, again, consistency of data, depth and quality of data across the entire world. But what's really, really exciting for me and something I'm very proud of is that we have now put a couple of metrics around gender equality into this ranking, which I hope sets a bar for future rankings and also provides an opportunity for us to examine this to be integrated into other rankings. When, for example, when we review the World University Ranking methodology from September, can we really have a global conversation about starting to put gender and more diversity metrics into the world rankings? So I think this is really exciting and pioneering. It's quite straightforward. It's quite simple in this instance.
What are the
metrics
that we
use
to measure
So at the moment, we're looking at the proportion of female students, and we're also looking at the proportion of female academic staff. I mean, I think this is just the start of this. We've chosen some relatively simple metrics there. One of the advantages of a simple metric is it's easy to understand. You know, we can explain this to a wide audience and get understanding of the metric. We can, in future years as well, look at expanding within that section. You know, there are other things we would like to look at. Economic disadvantage is a clear one we'd like to look at there as well. And in the States, we've looked at ethnic diversity as well. Now, the latter causes some real challenges within the European context because, or indeed within the teaching context, because different countries capture data on ethnic diversity in very different ways. And so that creates a challenge if we want to do that straightforwardly. So in the first instance, we are looking at gender metrics. And I think there is also a case for, in the longer term, about could we look at that in slightly different ways as well? Could we look at not just overall staff gender balance, but actually at higher levels? Is it the case that you have the glass ceiling in academia in the same way that we do in the commercial world?
Yeah, I think certainly leadership is something that will come back to us and people will start asking more questions around, you know, is it about senior leadership roles at the professorial level? Mm-hmm. So I think, again, part of the push around this is to try and encourage better reporting of information. And I think lots of people have attempted teaching-led rankings at a national level, but this is the first time it's been attempted seriously across nations. And although it's restricted to Europe and in the immediate phase restricted to Western Europe, it's the first time we've ever really started to build these blocks across nations. And ultimately there is a potential that we can not just expand it in Europe but start at least trying to map those broad indicators around the world, map it onto the US, map it onto what we're doing in Japan and push it beyond. So we see this very much as an exciting first step in a much longer journey, but we really do want to work carefully with the universities, manage expectations. There are missing nations, mm-hmm. there are missing institutions, there are institutions that are missing for things, you know, simple things like we didn't get the sufficiently significant samples or that they were hedging their bets and didn't want to take part in the early stages. This is a real call to action to say, look, when we launch this in Glasgow in a room full of people, we will stand up for a few hours poring over the details, not just the results, but poring over the methodology, being accountable for that methodology and using it as a springboard to say, if you think this is something, if you're as excited about it as we are, jump on board, get involved and help us build it out in the future.
What's been the biggest challenge, would you say, in comparing like for like across different countries? I mean, I used to live in Spain and I know that's a very different place to the Netherlands, for example. So What was your biggest challenge, would you say?
So I think there are two challenges. One is, both are associated with the nature of systems. One is much more directly in the university's control, I guess you could argue. But the first big challenge was around outcome measures. And we chose in the end to go for a relatively simple measure, which is graduation rate. You might say graduation rate, this is something straightforward and all universities should know this. But actually, graduation rate as a concept is hugely different in an open access system to a closed access system. So in the UK, we can very easily go to a university and say how many students who you accepted graduated. But if you go to the Netherlands, for example, where they have open access, what do you mean by that? Is it just everyone who turned up at the start? Is it everyone? And so on. So we've actually made some decisions around that where we're looking much more at this idea of people who go into the second year of study versus graduation. So if someone goes along to a university but isn't certain whether they want to continue that that particular career path, and after 6 months decide that's not for them, then we don't want to penalise universities and open systems when that happens. The second aspect, though, I guess you could argue, is much more around funding. And this is reflected, again, in the very different approaches to funding we see across Europe. And one of the arguments, there are many arguments for and against fees, but one of the arguments for the fees-based system we have in England and Wales is that it has provided English and Welsh universities with a steady and consistent stream of finance which isn't as easily manipulated by governments. And that has as we've seen, produced a very strong position, I would say, for UK institutions.
Yeah, the UK does exceptionally well in the ranking that we'll publish shortly, partly because I think the system is relatively well-resourced, certainly compared to Southern Europe. There's some real challenges on funding there. Also, again, I think partly to do with data availability. We have a very good, robust data system, so there's the inclusion of more British universities has been facilitated by good quality, publicly accessible data. So it's part of the push is to try and improve practices around other parts of the world to encourage better data collection, or at least more cooperation with us.
And what are you guys hoping to achieve with this ranking? I mean, we've talked a bit about expanding this to a global exercise, but we already have the World Reputation Rankings, we've got the US College Rankings. What are you guys hoping to, who are you targeting for this, and what kind of purpose are you hoping to serve?
I mean, I'd say at the fundamental level, there is a genuine sense that there is no single model of excellence in higher education. Now, with almost 15 years of the World University Rankings, we have created a global benchmark for what a world-class research university looks like, how you might measure that, how you might understand excellence in terms of global research universities. And I'm very proud of the work we've done there, although that evolves as well. We need to constantly improve and evaluate the metrics we use there. But for me, most fundamentally, it's saying that there are multiple types of excellence in higher education. You can be, you can have very limited research activity or no research activity. You could still be doing a great job against your mission if your mission is providing skilled citizens who contribute back to the society through the workforce. You could have completely different missions regarding social mobility, social impact. So I think for us, it's about saying, recognizing the diversity of excellence in the system. We don't want to put a Stanford or a Harvard model as the pinnacle that every single institution should emulate, because the reality is we need a diverse system, and we have a diverse system, and we should recognize the different roles universities play. So on that level, I think more rankings are better. More rankings with different outcomes are healthy, and they democratize rankings, and they allow institutions to understand themselves against their own missions, not to be constantly compared against some world-class research university if you're an inner-city social mobility institution, for example. So for me, it's about that. On the other side, of course, it is simply that we have a broad range of users. We as Duncan mentioned, we have governments looking at us, we have university leadership using the rankings for benchmarking, but we have something in the region of 25 million students coming to our website to gain an understanding of where is a good fit for them. At the moment, they use the World Rankings legitimately to look at the big picture, the big brand, the reassurance of academic excellence through reputation surveys, through research excellence. This offers them a more nuanced approach to say there are a wider range of options, and you can start building a basket of your own metrics and move beyond rankings towards profiling really digging much deeper and offering the user, the consumer, whoever they are, a much more nuanced approach to what excellence looks like. That's my sort of philosophy behind it.
Yeah, I just like the questions we can ask. We can start genuinely probing a very different aspect of what universities are. Now, is it the case that, let's pick on a random group of institutions, the Russell Group, are actually providing the value for money in terms of teaching? There's no doubt in terms of research, but are they doing it in terms of teaching? How does that compare with other systems? You know, is the money that we're putting, has the fee system in the UK actually made a difference? Or at the end of the day, would we all be better off going over to the Netherlands? Now, these are the kind of questions we can start digging into and start exploring, not just from the external perspective, but also from the student's perspective, what it really means to be a student, what it really means to receive an education. I think that's hugely exciting from a data perspective.
We should emphasise the student survey aspect is it will play a very large role in this ranking in terms of the weights and metrics. And that is truly pioneering in the sense that we're asking students themselves. And it's not like a UK...
It's not, are you happy?
It's not a satisfaction survey in the sense of what we've had in Britain. You know, are they delivering what you need? It's very much around, are you stretched? Are you challenged? Are you engaged? How are you applying your learning? And there are a few sort of metrics around, you know, would you recommend this course to a family member or friends? But it's a really rich data set, and applying that across a range of nations and the ability in future to map that against the, I think we get 100,000 responses a year across the United States. We've done that for 3 years now. We're pushing that into Japan to build that global picture of what students expect and how they're engaging with their own learning is, you know, really quite a revolutionary thing, I think, really exciting.
Absolutely. And something we don't actually use in the rankings, but is also adding really valuable qualitative information, is some of the comments we get back from students. And that provides, you know, additional insights into, again, what's life actually like? You know, does it make sense to go to University A? Let's pick on the one, Heidelberg. You know, how fantastic is Heidelberg doing? Is this the pinnacle? And that's really crucial for prospective students because, of course, any individual student only sees their own institution. Most students don't see more than one.
Yeah, there's no comparison.
It's hard to compare. Yeah. But here we're extracting that to a higher level, and we can say, well, yes, there are different flavours. There are universities who focus on different things. And I think we will see when we explore that some interesting surprises, even if not necessarily at the overall level. You know, we know the results, and I'm trying to be a bit Mark Commode here and not give away the plot line.
Well, I think,
but you know, with no spoilers, there are, as you dig deeper, you see themes and you see flavours of education coming through which aren't always captured in other approaches.
I think what we can say is that you map it against the world rankings and there will be some surprises. We are measuring different things, so different institutions will do well in this ranking compared to where they sit in a world ranking on based on research and prestige. So that's exciting. We are disrupting the perception of who's great because there are new unusual suspects will feature in this ranking in prominent positions. And I think what is really exciting when you drill down to the individual pillars, we call them, the individual scores within the overall score, you really do start to see some really different names coming up at the top of those lists. On the gender diversity, for example, you know, it's a great opportunity to demonstrate and showcase areas of excellence that are often hidden away.
Or indeed to encourage those universities who aren't performing there to do a better job in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Great. Well, you, Duncan and Phil, you will both be in Glasgow on July 11th at the Teaching Excellence Summit that we're hosting there to announce the results of this inaugural, also pilot version of the European Teaching Rankings. The methodology is up online on timeshighereducation.com, and I believe there are still some spaces available to attend the Teaching Excellence Summit. So if you're able to make it, it would be a great opportunity to speak with Duncan and Phil about this and tell them all about your worries and praises, which I'm sure there'll be plenty of. Thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.